and welcome to the podcast edition of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with authors and artists on books, movies, DVDs, collectibles, pretty much anything to do with the national pastime. If it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. George Vesey has been on the staff of the New York Times since the late 1960s. Although he took a buyout last December, he still contributes the occasional column. He's also the author of a dozen books, including Coal Miner's Daughter with Loretta Lynn, 5 o'clock Comes Early with Bob Welch, and Baseball, A History of America's Favorite Game. Most recently, Vesey has published Stan Musial and American Life. I spoke with him about his most recent project, as well as the changes he's seen in the publishing world over his long career. George Vesey, welcome to the bookshelf.
Hey, always nice talking to you.
So we're talking today about your latest book, which is Stan Musial, An American Life. Now, this has very personal meaning to you. You were a big Stan Musial fan as a young boy.
Absolutely. I grew up in Queens. I was a Brooklyn Dodger fan, and Musial used to come into Ebbets Field, play 11 games a year, and if you don't mind my lapsing into Brooklyn East for a minute, he used to moiter us.
Now, because you're a fan, but then because you're a professional, who writes for the New York Times, how did this, what was the genesis of this latest project?
Well, the genesis is, of course, I got to cover him a little bit when I was just breaking in at Newsday, and he was finishing up in 62 and 63. I went to his restaurant, and, you know, I've been around him enough, never really talked to him one-on-one, but I've been around him enough to know that I admired him as an adult. And many years later, I was doing a history book on baseball, and I did a little riff on Musial in that history book, just as sort of a 6 degrees of separation. Somebody saw it and said, you know, we've never done a real biography on Stan Musial. You ought to do it. You've got so anyway. It was more somebody else's idea. I could do it in my spare time from the Times. I'm kind of semi-laid back, retired right now. But I did it while I was working full-time, lots of free time, and didn't have access to Musial because he wasn't talking and really wasn't in shape to talk, but I certainly talked to enough of his friends and colleagues to get a good sense of him.
Now, excuse me, because you didn't have access to him, how do you think your book might have been different had you had that access?
You know, that's a great question. I would say this. He's not in shape. I mean, the word... what I learned while working on the book is from his daughter is that he has Alzheimer's. It really hadn't been publicized, but he's had it for 5-6 years. So he was in no shape to talk anyway. But about 15 years ago, he had stopped giving interviews because he was talked off about another book, a very good book that someone named James Giglio in Southwest Missouri had done on him, very well researched, and it just ticked off Musial, and he stopped giving interviews, and so did his immediate circle, most of his family, you know, a lot of his closest friends. Now, if I had talked to him when he was still, you know, all there, I suspect I certainly would have gotten his version of things. You know, on the other hand, he's not the most introspective person. I would have loved to have asked him what really happened in the clubhouse in 1947 when some of the Cardinals didn't want to play, the Southerners, and you being from Western Pennsylvania, you know, you obviously did play. I don't know that he... ever was geared to open up his veins and bleed a little bit for somebody else, but I certainly would have loved it if I'd had the chance to ask him.
Now, the things that are mentioned in that book, I believe, have to do with his the marriage and the timing of the birth of his first child.
Yeah.
You don't concern yourself with any of that stuff.
No. I mean, I mentioned it casually in the book. I kind of gloss over it. I don't use the words. But this writer, the researcher Giglio, did a great job and discovered that Musial and his wife had a wedding in a church in Florida in, I don't know, May or June of 1940. and the son was born a couple of months later, and they say they were married that the winter before. Well, you know, there's not necessarily any proof paper to it, and that's as far as I'll go. Like, so what? It really doesn't, you know, they've been married 70 years.
Okay, now, does that have anything to do with the fact that you're a mutual fan?
No. I don't think so. I don't think so, in the sense that, to me, it's such a minor detail in life. I can understand why they would not want it spelled out, or, you know, semi-spelled out by somebody else, but it's just my own personal decision. I think I'd have the same discretion if I were writing about anybody, unless it were the key part of somebody's life, in which case, I mean, when there are key parts, when somebody has a, you know, a dichotomy in behavior, and it's part of their, the central part of their personality, of course, as a writer, you know, whether you like them or not, you go after it. I mean, there are other things to ask about Musial. People have raised the question as to whether he really, you know, how cool he was on Race, and from everything I've been able to discover, without ever making a speech about it, or, you know, you can't find a quote anywhere, this is a guy who let his teammates know in 1947, I'm in, I'm playing, I'm from Western Pennsylvania, I had black guys on my high school basketball team, I'm in. And that's good enough for me. I go into quite strong, if I'd found other things, like that he was a little bit weaker on it, of course I would have done that.
Now, you mentioned discretion. That's an interesting word nowadays, because there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of discretion in a lot of the biographies that come out about iconic American figures.
No, I think it's a matter, if you read it and you got the point from reading my book, then I did what I accomplished, which is to say, yes, there's this, and personally, I don't, but I think readers, and particularly people who pick up hard-covered books and get a couple hundred pages into it and go over one paragraph and say, oh, okay, I've done my job. I don't need to spell it out. I mean, I got, working for the New York Times, one of the things I realized decades ago is I've got smart readers. I don't have to write like it's a tabloid or a, you know, page six kind of paper or something. I got smart readers who can deal with subtleties. I don't have to be the sneering, sniggering, you know, tab reporter. You can get by with the subtleties are important.
Well, it almost seems like a throwback to the day when reporters just did not write about the players' lives off the field.
No, you know, I certainly wouldn't say that, because I think lives off the field are very important. Look, if I had learned that Musial had, you know, let's just say I've got the chapter in there about him going on the road in 1960 to campaign for John F. Kennedy. The narrator of that chapter is the lovely Angie Dickinson. One of the most gorgeous women I've ever seen. Happened to see her at a ballpark in 1962, and I'm, you know, still kind of quivering over the site. And a lovely woman helped me tremendously with the chapter. If somehow it had come out that, you know, they had an affair or something, of course I would have found a way to, you know, to write that. I as long as one could document it, if it were in there somewhere. But there's nothing to suggest that. So my point is that I don't think you're backing away from things. It's the important things you find out. I mean, if somebody's not what they say they are, that's important. You know, subtle details, put them in there, but put them in perspective. I'm all for perspective.
Yeah, he almost seems to be like a character out of the early 1960s TV, like Father Knows Best or the Ozzie and Harriet Show.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And it makes him who he is. He was not very complicated. I mean, to talk to his oldest daughter, Jerry, who was the one person in the family who did cooperate with me, and cooperate, meaning that she talked about her dad in very positive terms. Do I think I got full shot of what she knows? You know, who knows? But she certainly gave me a lot of subtleties. When I asked her about her dad talking about his childhood, which was not only poor, but also had some issues in the family. His father obviously had drank. His mother was more protective toward the two boys who came along at the end. Jerry was very protective of her family, but I went with those subtleties.
Is there anyone who didn't like Stan Musial?
I think there were a few. you know, there's talk that some of the Southerners, I mean, you know, Slaughter and other guys probably weren't too happy with him in 1947 when it was clear that he was going to play because, frankly, it backed them into a corner. It was impossible for someone like Slomanali, was he threatened with, you know, if you ever miss a game, if you don't take the field against the Brooklyn Dodgers, you're out of baseball. Well, that was enough. But Musial was the one who put them into that corner by his absolutely going to take the field and being, you know, fairly positive toward Jackie Robinson on the field. So I think that there were a few of the younger African-American players who came along in the early 60s. The Cardinals were a tough organization. They were very slow to get black players. Ultimately, they did get a lot of talent. You know, Kurt Flood, Bob Gibson, Bill White, they traded for them, they brought them in. And some of the players would roll their eyes at Musial because he was like a company man. He lived in the town. He was an old white guy. Didn't particularly socialize. I mean, he was a different generation, a different era from these young black guys, and they certainly rolled their eyes. Bob Gibson at one point counted the number of wonderfuls that Musial did. Nowadays, Musial and Gibson have the same agent, and Gibson is extremely fond of Musial, talks about him. It's the difference between a 24-year-old and a, you know, whatever Gibby is now.
Right.
You come to the one person I thought didn't really care for Musial was Bill White, whom I've known for a long time. White was a leader, you know, one of the smartest guys in that Cardinal clubhouse in the 60s. He felt that Musial was a little bit distant, just wasn't interested at all in anybody young, and particularly the black players. It wasn't racist. It was just he was from a different culture. George Crowe, who came along, was Musial's age. He passed recently. George was a leader of the black players, and truthfully, on other teams, he'd been a leader of white players, too. With the Cardinals, he was just a backup first baseman. He said Musial and pinch hitter, and he said Musial really didn't pay too much attention to him in that clubhouse, which is sad that Musial could be in a clubhouse with Gibson, but do I think it's racism? No, of course not. Do I think that he was a certain way, that he had his friends, he had his lifestyle? Yeah, and I can understand why some people would be, but only a few. I mean, a very few. And then there's the feud with Joe Garagiola, which came out of a very strong friendship and a business relationship. And then things went wrong in the business relationship, which I go into in some detail in the book. And, you know, Graziola and Musial haven't spoken for, you know, what, 20 years, and, you know, clearly never will.
That's a great shame, especially at this stage of their lives.
Well, yeah. I mean, Graziola feels it. I'm close to Joe. I've known Joe a long time. And when I talk to him about it, he's full of pain. In fact, I'll share this with you. When the book came out last May or June, I was on my deck and my cell phone rang and it was Garagiola calling from Arizona. And I know him, and his heart was on his sleeve. He said, George, you did right by me. I just read the book. You were fair. He had told me a few things off the record, which I'd sort of layered in there pretty subtly. And he said, you were fair to me. He said, but you know, you were also fair to Stan. And the guy deserves it. And you got it right. And so the fact that Joe could see that I had worked very hard to present both their sides or what they may have thought about this business disagreement, Joe can understand that I was trying to be fair to both people.
The subtitle of the book is An American Life, and you do spend a lot of time talking about things far afield from the ballpark. You talk about life in Denora. You talk about life in the mines. You talk about Musial's trip to visit the Pope. You spent a lot of time with that. These are major events in his life.
It's what I do. I mean, I'm not a sports writer per se. You know, I've been a national reporter. I covered that part of the country for the New York Times. And I'd like to think that anybody doing a biography of Stan Musial would step far away from, you know, how many hits he got in a doubleheader to what produced this Stan the Man personality, the American Life. I didn't come up with that subtitle. Actually, I was going to call it The Forgotten Man. And they said, no, we want a little bit more positive. I think the subtitle is brilliant because it really is what I was doing. I mean, I loved being a national correspondent for the New York Times, a news reporter, traveling the mountains in the Appalachian region. And the book shows the kind of hard work and poverty in this town that's now a ghost town. I even go into the origin of the name Denora. The Nora in that was the wife of the Mellon from Pittsburgh who owned the part of the U.S. Steel. And I make the point that Musil was a product of that environment, that he is from Western Pennsylvania. He's not from from the South or the East. He's from Western Pennsylvania, and it's a very American story of poverty and immigration.
The Forgotten Man would have been a great subtitle also, because among his contemporaries, Mays, Mantle, Snyder, he does seem to be the Forgotten Man.
Yeah, I think they just wanted a little bit more positive. I mean, people in St. Louis have a complex about Musil anyway, the fact that he's been overlooked by the East Coast and the West Coast and the media types. I mean, they certainly feel that strongly, but the publisher wanted to be as positive as possible in the title, and I can, I'm glad that they did it. I listen to people who know their business, and not that I even think I had much choice. I wasn't wed into it, but it is, I think it's a terrific title. The Forgotten Man works off the song in the musical High Society, where Frank Sinatra is twitting Bing Crosby, the ex-husband, about being the forgotten man. They sing a duet called, "I have heard among this clan you are called the forgotten man," and then Bing Crosby says, "Well, did you ever? What a swell party this is." So that was the thing. Well, whether I'm sure I would have had to work out the rights to use it from whoever owns the rights to that music. I think it's Cole Porter, but It didn't come to that, and I think the publisher was right in going with An American Life.
Now, I want to switch gears just a bit and talk about the business side of producing a book. You've been writing, obviously, for a long time. How has the craft of production changed since your first book?
Now, are you talking about the actual physical production of a book since I first started?
No, I think I'm talking about more of the business angle. Mm-hmm. Of the you know how things are going now in the book production industry,
right?
With e-books and whatnot.
Right.
So, and authors are called upon to do a lot more, I think, now than they ever used to.
Well, this was not the case with this book. In other words, I didn't have to do any accompanying videos or there was no e-component to it. It is available. You fire up your Kindles and order it by all means. But no, from my point of view, it was a traditional book sale. Electronic rights were included in it, which is a whole new world. But I didn't have to do anything different. What I did was I went out and I did my research for, in fact, 2 years. They wanted me to turn the book in a year, and I said, well, that's ridiculous. So I went out and I talked to as many people as possible, laid out a bunch of phone calls, and eventually got them back. I wrote the book. The one way in which things have changed over the years, I mean, don't forget, when I started writing kids' books back in the mid-60s, I was writing them on the road on my Olivetti portable typewriter, coming home on a more standard Underwood. But it was all on paper. So if you wanted to rewrite a chapter, you had to cut and paste and scissor, and it was a nightmare to retype things. Nowadays, with computers, which have been in since the mid-70s, where I've been writing on that you can change things so easily. I don't understand anybody who writes in law. I mean, I can understand your soul flowing into your hand, into your pen, and all that. But it is so easy to move copy around. You write a chapter, and you say, "Now wait a minute, this chapter is out of place. It really needs to be. I need to take this half of this chapter and move it up." I mean, you can cut and paste right up until. I'll give you one example. The ceremony for the Presidential Medal was last February 15th in Washington, D.C. Musil got the Presidential Medal. President Obama put, I was there. Somebody scored a pass for me to sit in with family and members and so on. And the next day, a friend of mine, the news photographer for the White House, the Times photographer at the White House, Doug Mills, who was at the Super Bowl the other day, at the Super Bowl in Indianapolis, Doug had taken a few extra pictures of the ceremony just because he knew that I was going to. I asked him, "Would you snap off a few, and we'll work it out separately and so on." He sent me one of the president putting the medal over Musil's head, and the smile on Musil's face I had not seen, even though I had a direct view. I was in the 10th row or something. I didn't see that smile. Doug caught it spot on. And when I saw that, my wife looked at it, and she said, "Well, that's got to be the back cover." So I called the publisher. Now, we were days away from pushing the final button. I was going to fine-tune some of the copy. I had saved space, which you can do electronically. But we told them, hey, this really, and they took a look at the photo, and they put it on the back cover. They retooled the back cover in, you know, hours, if not minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a whole other world. Now, what do I see coming down the pike? I mean, to finish your thought, I know that at some point I'll do another book, and I think the rules and the opportunities are going to be different. I mean, there's sort of a cattle herder, sheep herder business going on between e-books and Amazon starting up its end of electronic books and the traditional publishing. I personally think that people who read books are going to want the physical product in the foreseeable future. Forget about, you know, in my lifetime, but you know, in a lot of people's lifetimes, that I think that there are going to be people who will pay. I mean, the price for books now, my book is listed at $26. It's cheaper in some, you know, Amazon, all that. But I think people will be willing to pay for a book as well as a newspaper in the foreseeable future, even if there are fewer people willing to pay for it, that it's something that they're going to want and that the economics will be, it can be produced. You just have to pay for it, whether it's $26 or $28 or $30. The price will go up to some degree, but the idea of holding it, so I think there are going to be books for a long time.
I hope so.
I hope so, too. I mean, I have no interest. I don't have a Kindle, but goodness knows I read an awful lot online. I mean, I'm online all the time writing. I've got a website, georgevesey.com, that I write for. It's my own. I produce it myself. I can, in fact, write the headlines, you know, pull in the visual material, push the button on it, edit it. I mean, it's nuts that you have the means of your own expression, and it can be out flying around the world in seconds. My cousin in London read something last night that I had just put online. You know, she looked at it about the Super Bowl the other day. So it's nuts. But do I think there are going to be books? Yes.
Well, what about you? You mentioned you didn't do a video for the book, but what about the other ancillary things? I know you were at the Bergino Baseball Clubhouse not that long ago talking about the book, which is what I meant about the authors. You know, the authors are sometimes called upon to put up a dedicated website for the book. They're asked to appear at places like this. Do you enjoy that aspect of the production?
More than I used to. No, I don't know what you know, Random House Ballantyne has done in that respect. I know that I've got my own website where I do have, you know, one portion of it is reserved to that book. You know, I talk about it a little bit, and I've got lists of my books and all of that. But on a broader basis, do I enjoy publicizing? Well, I've always not enjoyed it particularly, but I knew that I had to do it. I mean, I've never particularly enjoyed, if I can talk personally for a minute, I've never particularly enjoyed, you know, promoting myself or even going on television. I thought that was intrusive to my real job. When I was on television, I wasn't learning anything. I was just babbling and showing off, whereas I needed to be out working. So I've turned down a lot of television over the years, just didn't care. It wasn't important to me. But two things happened. One is that in the broader electronic world that we're happening, even the New York Times went 180 degrees, and instead of telling us not to be so much on TV, they wanted, you know, all of a sudden you looked and you said, you know, the old guard was like, oh, we shouldn't be, we're supposed to be out working, and then the new breed was in there, you know, preening and doing their thing on television, and that's what they wanted. It was the electronic age. So I totally get the shift. You know, you're pushing the brand and all that. But even beyond that, in my old age, and I'm old, I've become more comfortable in doing live TV or, you know, speaking in front of a group, and whatever the reason is, I'm more comfortable in my own skin. So, yeah, I kind of like it.
Have you heard the audio version of your book?
A bit, yeah.
And what do you think about that?
It's very nice. I did a good job. I'm thrilled that there is one. I have a friend named Ed Lucas who's been blind since he was a kid, and he's a baseball buff who does a lot of, you know, reporting, feature writing about the Yankees. He's at Yankee Stadium a lot, and I was able to hand him. He was up at Yankee Stadium. I gave him a big hug and said who I was, and, you know, we know each other, and I handed him the audio version. I was thrilled that I was able to hand him a Stan Musial book that he could listen to.
One of the things I was thinking of is like a playwright crafting the play and then hearing the words read by somebody else. When you write, I imagine you hear the words one way. I'm just curious. I know the narrator a little bit. I was wondering if you felt that the way he presented was the way you had envisioned it, or I guess envision in an audio case is not the accurate word, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. I think the guy's, I'm blanking on the name, but
Scott Brennan.
He was, yeah, I mean, I heard from him. He checked over some pronunciations with me. He's a real professional. I think his nuances, I'd rather listen to his voice than mine. You know, there are some people you'd like to hear them reading. I mean, somebody gave me James Joyce reading some of his short stories and bits from Ulysses. I mean, that's a trip and a half. So, but that's one thing, but I don't know that anybody's waiting, you know, they may want to hear James Joyce reading Ulysses, but I don't know if they want to hear Vesey reading Musial.
You mentioned you have something else in the works?
Do not. If you got any good ideas, I'm open to them. I took a buyout from the Times at the end of December and thought I'd be, I quoted my Liverpool non-cousin John Lennon as saying to watch the wheels go round and round, but in reality, I'm busier than ever with my own website. Then the Times made me an offer to stay on and write one or two columns a month as a, quote, contributor. So, I mean, even at the Super Bowl, I stayed up late at home to write a blog overnight that they would use because, somebody asked me to. So, you know, I'm still very much involved at the paper and with my own website. And if you got any good ideas for a book, wouldn't mind doing that.
Very good. Hi, we've been talking this morning with George Vesey, author of San Musial and American Life. George, thank you very much.
Hey, thanks a lot, man.
And that was the Bookshelf Conversation with George Vesey, author of Stan Musial and American Life. Well, that about does it for another podcast edition of The Bookshelf. Visit us at Ron Kaplan's baseballbookshelf.com for the latest news on baseball books and other media. And drop us a line at ron@ronkaplan'sbaseballbookshelf.com. So long, everybody.